You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko kēs te tōku ingoa. Nau mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire Whareahina Monday. I'm your host, Caster, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producers Thomas and Jude. If I can, coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about selling conservation land, youth unemployment, and arts and culture funding for Auckland's CBD. Thomas, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to University of Auckland Professor of Conservation Biology James Russell about the Conservation Amendment Bill, and I talked to University of Auckland Professor Dr. Sally McKay about making food health star ratings mandatory.
And Jude, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to Auckland University Senior Research Fellow Dr. Sarah Jane Guild about the development of wireless brain sensors.
He aha, o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395. Wai mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kawa e wareware e ahena koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakihere rokiroki maronga i te pai, tukutuku o irerangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more as always by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
The government's Conservation Amendment Bill includes plans to sell up to 60% of New Zealand's conservation land. The government argues that much of this land is not your typical conservation land, rather that it includes farmland and other unused areas without environmental benefits. The bill's opponents, however, say this isn't the full story, and that the government's criteria for sale opens room to sell large portions of land currently inhabited by our native flora and fauna. The policy also paves the way for further sales of conservation land, which is especially concerning because of the minimal public influence on the decision, despite the fact that it affects public assets. The concerns are further compounded by the release of a Curia market research poll this morning on public support for the sale of conservation land. Not only are the majority of the population opposed, but this opposition extends to the majority of National and ACT voters and half of NZ First voters. Youth unemployment is also an issue in the news cycle this week, with rates at a 30-year high. Despite this government being in power for almost 3 years, improvements are difficult to find. Lastly, last week saw announcements that Flying Out Record Store and Neck of the Woods will both be closing. These announcements follow the closure of Verona Cafe and Bar and the cancellation of the Others Way Festival for 2026. With Auckland's arts and culture funding seeing cuts each year, there are calls for the government to take action to support these businesses and communities. For this week's catch-up with the ACT Party, Simon Court, I asked about each of these issues, beginning with the Conservation Amendment Bill. I want to start off with the proposals to sell conservation land. It's a pretty big policy from the government, putting up to 60% of our conservation land on sale. Why is the government so interested in selling all of this?
Well, New Zealanders expect DOC to focus on land that has high conservation values and not hold on to every odd strip, you know, gravel reserve, every building and works depot, or low-value pastoral farmland forever. Because a lot of this land was dumped in the DOC bucket, as they call it, back in the late 80s and early 90s. And it came from the old Electricity Corporation of New Zealand and a number of other government entities. And the intention was that DOC would sort through all of this land, identify what land had high conservation values and should be added to the conservation estate, and what land could be set to some other purpose. Now, whether that was sold or handed over to some other state-owned enterprise at the time wasn't clear. And it's just been left, like, for 40 years. So this is the first government that's had the courage to say, is a job that we were supposed to have finished, we're now going to progress it. by identifying land that has high conservation values, adding that to the conservation estate, and using the process of putting up land for sale to identify what is its actual commercial value. Can we realise that? We're not going to sell it if we're only getting cents on the dollar. But if we can get significant revenues coming back to the Crown from it, then we can put that back into conservation.
From an economic perspective, though, there's been some concerns over it, especially because of how much New Zealand's unique natural environment contributes to our tourism sector. There's a lot of native wildlife that you're going to find on much of this conservation land. There's also a lot of walks, you know, tramps and hikes that will happen across some of this conservation land. Is that a concern to the government that we could be kneecapping our tourism sector a little bit with a change like this?
Look, I think there's been quite a bit of misinformation about what is intended. We've got great walks. We've got all kinds of nature reserves and scenic reserves operated by the Department of Conservation. Most of this land is not conservation land. It is land that is under the control of the landlord, the Department of Conservation. And the reason it's the reason that DOC is the landlord is because of decisions made in many cases, 40 years or more ago about dumping this land on DOC. So we're talking about works depots in small towns where there's a couple of sheds and where DOC parks their Hilux. And we're talking about pastoral farmland that's always been farmed, in many cases for over 100 years, where DOC leases it to farmers, and there was never any intention that that land be included in, say, a recreation reserve or a scientific reserve or one of our national parks. It's that land that the government is looking to sell and get the revenue to invest in actual conservation land, like you were describing, the walking trails, places popular with tourists, and those places that have very high conservation and biodiversity values, where currently the government doesn't have enough money to pay to maintain those areas.
Are you confident that none of those such areas would be seeing any sales if this policy were to go through?
Yeah, the government's been very clear about the land that DOC administers that should be subject to some kind of commercial test. And it's not the national parks, it's not the places that you or I, if we were tourists to New Zealand, would want to go and visit. Now, these are places that most New Zealanders wouldn't recognise as being conservation land. There's large pine plantations on them, there's stock grazing on them, or there are quarries and mines on them. And so, look, it makes sense for DOC to have a look at its land parcel, all of its holdings, and decide which ones it can actually say, look, we can put a commercial test on them. If somebody wants to pay us to take that off our hands, that's fine because it has low conservation value and we can use that revenue to invest in a conservation estate, which taxpayers do struggle to fund in a way that New Zealanders want us to.
That being said, you know, from the other side of things, this is public land, right? And so owned by the state, every taxpayer has an interest in this land. And if we look at taxpayers, there's poll results that have come out this morning from a Curia market research poll. 64% of people oppose the idea of selling conservation land. 46% in that 64 strongly oppose. Even among ACT voters, 63% oppose this policy. That's a lot of people who don't want this policy going anywhere. Is the government looking at these numbers and reconsidering? I mean, it's really hard to justify, in my view at least, when so many people are clearly opposed to a policy like this.
Well, yeah, Castor, as I've explained, we're not selling land with high conservation values. So the way that question was pitched might not have been clear about that. If the question has been pitched, is it okay for the government to sell a works depot with a couple of sheds on it where we park the Hilux in town and use that money to invest in tracks and trails and biodiversity on the conservation estate, you'd probably get a different answer. So, look, we're confident we're on the right track. It's a task that was meant to have been undertaken over 40 years ago when all of this land was dumped into the DOC landholding bucket. It was never done because successive governments wouldn't prioritise it. And frankly, they were afraid of the kind of backlash that we're hearing about now. But our job, my job as an ACT MP, you know, I was an environmental scientist before I became an engineer, is to explain to people why it's important to make these trade-offs. You know, selling some lower value land or land with very low or no conservation values and investing that money in the things that are important to all of us. So, you know, I know it's difficult for some people to get their heads around, but because it's called conservation land doesn't mean it has high conservation or any conservation values at all. We do want to invest in conservation values.
But, I mean, the government has done a lot of explaining around this bill, and ACT is constantly preaching the importance of democracy right in our decision-making. If people are opposed to it, and massively, as this poll indicates, then surely there should be some room for reconsideration.
Well, I guess the question is, what would you reconsider? I mean, would you propose that we have a referendum on every works depot, every gravel pit, every paddock that's had, you know, beef and sheep grazing in it for 100 years? And who's going to have a say on this referendum? In the end, you know, what voters do, they outsource some of the more difficult policy matters and decisions to elected representatives. My job as an ACT Member of Parliament and somebody with a bit of background in, you know, conservation and ecology and, you know, monitoring the natural environment and protecting it in my work, you know, I want to make sure that we do make good decisions, and I'm happy to go out there and explain them to people. But I am concerned when I hear the way the question was framed and you know, the poll results you've described, that probably most of the people hearing about this stuff for the first time won't understand the nuance and what's actually going on. And so, you know, I do feel a sense of responsibility, and thank you for giving me the opportunity on the show to explain those differences and why investing in biodiversity and protecting conservation values on high-value conservation land will always be a priority for any government in New Zealand.
I want to move on now to the economy. We've seen fuel prices still up despite some of the ceasefire arrangements between the US and Iran. We've also seen unemployment still high, with youth unemployment last week's statistics coming out seeing it at the highest in 3 decades. This government's been in for almost 3 years now, and we haven't seen a significant increase in the state of the economy. How is that looking as we're going towards this year's election?
Well, at an individual level, when you're looking at the bills coming in, and you know, you're looking in your wallet to see what's left over at the end of the week, it can be very hard for people to feel that the country has turned around. But what some of the high-level statistics are telling us is that actually, you know, GDP has increased. It was like 0.8% for the last quarter, which might tell you that, you know, we were headed for over 3% growth if it wasn't for the fuel price spike as a result of the war in Iran. So the fundamentals are improving. Now, what this government has done, it has reduced wasteful spending. It has reduced the pressure on inflation by actually controlling the things that taxpayers voted for this coalition government to control. And as a result, it's meant that the Reserve Bank has been able to offer lower interest rates. People who are seeking to buy their first home, they don't have to save as much of a deposit to get into their first home because house prices have flattened off. And it is becoming more affordable to invest in plant and equipment and machinery so you can grow your business and employ people, particularly people coming out of school, coming out of training and coming out of university. So that's certainly the macro picture, but at an individual level, we understand that a lot of people are doing it tough and wondering how they're going to make ends meet from week to week. And that's why this government, and particularly acting government, is focused on cutting red tape, making sure that, you know, small businesses can grow and hire people and afford to give people a pay rise, and not threatening, new taxes like the Greens, dare I say, like my colleagues in the National Party, saying they're going to take 12.5% of your paycheck off you to stick in compulsory KiwiSaver, when actually, you know, when you're starting your first job, you might have to save for other things or pay off other bills. So, you know, ACT is thinking about what people are going through right now.
Yeah, and lastly, I want to talk about arts and culture funding a bit, because we've seen recently in Auckland, I mean, last week we saw the announcements that Flying Out Record Store and Neck of the Woods are both looking at closing, and earlier this year we saw announcements about Verona Cafe and Bar on K Road as well, and the Others Way Festival, which has been on K Road historically, is not going to run this year. This is pretty distressing for anyone living in and around the CBD, for people who are big on the music culture that we're seeing in Auckland, and that culture is slowly slipping away as costs continue to rise and without significant support. Is the government looking at anything to help address this and to help improve things for these organisations?
Look, the government's books are under massive pressure, but I totally get how upset people are when their favourite venue, their favourite cafe closes, you know, like Neck of the Woods or Verona. Every generation's got its fave venues and, you know, retailers which simply don't survive changes in technology and sometimes consumer demand. I used to be semi-regular and coherent downstairs as a drum and bass band. You know, a while ago I've seen London Electricity and Logistics at Coherent. But, you know, that operator's closing and they've opened the mothership. So there's still a home for drum and bass in Auckland. And, you know, when it comes to technology, it's sad to see vinyl record stores close. But, you know, we've had Spotify and digital music and, you know, lossless audiophile quality digital music available, you know, at the click of a download for quite a while now. So, you know, the government can't be there to support all of these businesses. But what we certainly can do is make it easier for businesses that do want to set up, easier to get a liquor licence, and reduce all of that regulatory burden that we hear from many hospitality businesses saying council inspectors are coming and they're giving us a hard time about things. They don't seem to understand, you know, how we keep people safe when it comes to serving food and how we keep people safe on our premises when we're serving alcohol. We get objections from left, right and centre. So, you know, ACT is thinking about, you know, how businesses can employ more people and how we can make our cities and towns more vibrant. You've got to look at City Rail Link. You know, when that project is finally finished, I predict there will be a renaissance in K Road. You know, I've been a fan of K Road since I was a kid, going along to the George Court department store with my dad when he used to work in that building, and seeing how K Road's changed over the years. You know, sometimes it's on the up, and unfortunately, recently it hasn't looked that flash. So there's a bit of work to do, but, you know, I would expect to see a renaissance in the next few years.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court speaking to me about the Conservation Amendment Bill, youth unemployment and arts and culture funding for Auckland.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
We'll be right back after this short break. This is Wellington Is Dead by Breaches.
Thank you. Wow, we get along so well. I feel like I've known you my whole life.
I know, it's crazy. I'd love to see you again.
Sorry, I just have to ask. Your hoodie is so random. What is 95BFM?
Oh, I knew this was too good to be true.
What? Wait, where are you going?
No!
Show the world exactly who you are with our range of classic 95BFM merch. From the BSA slogan t-shirt to ringer tees and hoodies, get yours now at twotonesmerch.co.nz.
On Wednesday night, you've climbed the mountain of the week and reached the top, but before you roll down the hill, you get a reward. No, it's not the view. This is radio. No, you don't get to meet an all-powerful being. This is an alternative radio station. At the top of the mountain, you get the top 10 songs of the week on 95BFM. Brought to you by the Mountain Guardians.
The 95BFM Top 10. The toppest top tracks of the week. 7 to 8pm every Wednesday. Vote online at 95bfm.com/vote.
Money. It's made up.
It's in a jar, in the car, in a drawer, on the floor. It's all over the place.
But we need it to keep making awesome radio.
So where's your loose change?
Donate to the 95BFM. Give a little.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
After passing its first reading in May, submissions are currently open for the Conservation Amendment Bill, which would see up to 60% of current conservation land become open for sale, as long as it's not considered important for threatened species. Additionally, the bill adds a new responsibility to the Department of Conservation to recognise and enable economic opportunities as much as possible from the land and resources it manages. The bill has faced large public pushback, with a recent poll finding that 64% of New Zealanders oppose it, including the majority of the current government coalition's regular voters. With submissions closing on the 2nd of July, I spoke to University of Auckland Professor of Conservation Biology, James Russell, about the bill and its contentious proposals. This new Conservation Amendment Bill proposes to make a large amount of conservation land easier to sell and pushes more kind of a economic opportunistic goal onto the Department of Conservation. What impacts could these two changes have on conservation in New Zealand?
I think that's the key point here. The bill's trying to wrap up a whole bunch of things into one, and that is both the economic enabling conditions on conservation land as well as, where appropriate, the exchange or disposal of conservation land. And so I think a really interesting starting point is going back to when the Department of Conservation was formed in 1987, and that was a big times in New Zealand government, and the merger there was bringing together a bunch of agencies' duties under one umbrella organisation, being the Department of Conservation. So in particular, you saw the Forest Service, the New Zealand Forest Service, the Department of Lands and Survey, and the New Zealand Wildlife Service come together. And so with that, their land came together and they all got put under the Department of Conservation. And I think that was a really good thing for New Zealand to do back then, because our Department of Conservation is hands down the envy of the world. We hosted a conference on island invasive species in February this year, and people around the world were just going, New Zealand, how do you do it? How do you have a single Department of Conservation looking after 33% of your land and doing it so well? And that's where we see the real power of the Department of Conservation, that they just have all of this land that they can manage in totality across New Zealand for the benefits of conservation. But that doesn't mean we don't get some challenges. So, for example, even though the Department of Conservation is responsible for 33% of New Zealand's land, the Department of Conservation budget is routinely less than 2% of the actual national government budget. So you can see that first mismatch there, that we've got a lot of conservation land, but due to the challenges of government and having to manage, you know, across health and education and law and order, you have to prioritise where the money goes. So we've got a lot of great conservation land and a lot of great conservation opportunity and a lot of great conservation need across that conservation estate, but not enough money to do it. So I can see that at a high level there's this good intent that we need to find ways to better match things up, but then the challenge lands in how this bill might be able to do that.
You mentioned there that, you know, our Department of Conservation is the envy of the world. I think quite a lot of New Zealanders, this is kind of touches on those environmental values that we hold ourselves proud of. Do you think they've handled this properly and with the amount of care that New Zealanders would like to see with it?
I think that's really one of the key points here, which is that New Zealanders, one of the other great benefits of being a New Zealander is you're always pretty close to conservation and you can see what nature used to look like. And I don't think any of us want to be in a position where we do have these great national parks, but at the bottom of the South Island, and if you're an Aucklander that wants to go to visit the Dock National Park, you have to go all the way to the bottom of the South Island. South Island. So I think New Zealanders really support having this huge conservation network across the country and want to see it maintained and don't want to see that land area diminished. So I think probably in terms of handling this, there's been the conflict that's emerged as the New Zealand government has created this bill, and they're trying to just wrap up too many things in it at once, and as this government has tended to do, move it through too fast as an enabling legislation agenda. And so that's created these problems where Forest and Bird has pointed out, hey, although you say you only want to get rid of the Met Service land in Wellington or the gravel pit down on the West Coast, you've actually devised this bill in such a way that over half of our conservation land could be exchanged or disposed of. And the government's come back and said, well, we don't intend to do that. We're just planning to set up this economic enabling legislation, which in itself is a particular challenge for how we might interpret that. But you end up in that dilemma. It's like, well, if this isn't what the law is intended to do, it's what the law could allow you to do, and we don't want to be at the vicissitudes of a future government or even this government then changing their mind once the enabling agenda's in place.
Especially when, you know, once you've sold this conservation land off, it's going to be quite difficult to protect it, maybe potentially get it back. So with that permanence that it might be able to allow, is that something that should be really carefully considered?
Exactly. I think conservation land, we kind of see it as undeveloped land, and so it can be sold off for a very low value. And we saw that challenge with the High Country 10-year review process, where conservation land was sold off for a much lower value than what it could then be used for. And so at two levels, when we sell off the land and it gets developed or changed, it's much more expensive to restore it back. But even if we sell off that land but then change our mind and want to buy it back, we just end up locked in this challenge where it's just so expensive to buy it back. And once again, when your national budget is only less than 2% of the government's annual budget, then you just don't have the funding to do that. There's been some great occurrences in New Zealand's past where crowds have got together and crowdfunded to buy more land to add to the conservation estate, but that's more the exception rather than the rule. And I think that's what we need to keep our eye on here, that it's exceptions rather than the rule. The Met Service land and the gravel pit are exceptions to the rule, and they're outliers, and it would make sense to be able to dispose of them or trade them off for better conservation land, but that certainly shouldn't extend to our over half of our conservation estate.
Now, the bill does say that land which is essential to threatened species won't be sold off. Are you happy with the amount of protections for our native flora, fauna and kind of general ecosystem?
The Wildlife Act itself is quite a dated piece of legislation, and so there's some additional need that we could see here to reform that legislation, which hasn't been done in the revisions proposed here. We need better regulatory enforcement, and we also have a lot of threats to our conservation land which we need to work towards. So I think the other thing we have to be aware of in the development of this bill is the way that very particular wording can lead to very different outcomes. So things such as enable economic development where it is most practical, or protect threatened species where it is important, really comes down to people's different interpretations of evidence of what is economically practical at a site and what a threatened species level of investment should be. So, for example, I might think that putting in a new dock hut is a good economic development on dockland that enables recreational opportunities, but someone else might very well think putting in a 5-story hotel is an appropriate recreational development, and that just comes down to our different views of what a practical economic development is. And likewise, when it comes down to protecting threatened species, some people might think, well, if there's a kakapo or a takahe there, it should absolutely be protected, whereas I might say, well, if there's a mohua or a piwaka waka going through there, then that's also a threatened species that would warrant some form of protection. So it's really that's the thing we need to get right when creating the new legislation, that it doesn't create these slippery slopes where, which is exactly what Forest and Bird have identified, that although the minister has identified a very small form of exchange and disposal that might occur, the legislation's created this very slippery slope where a lot more could happen than probably most New Zealanders would be comfortable with.
And submissions for the bill are open currently. Do you think if the right changes were made to it, it's still salvageable, or should it be right back to the drawing board?
I think good legislation takes years to put together and really has to be done through a cross-party purpose. That's more and more clear. I was just discussing this with a colleague in the corridor today, that if we keep flip-flopping and becoming more polarised with our agendas between each government, we're not going to create legislation that can last for 100 or 1,000 years to protect the land, which is the scale that the land works on. So I think we do need to look at enabling opportunities for where there are sensible trades to be made. The Department of Conservation probably doesn't need to be owning Met Service land or gravel pits, but at the same time we want to make sure that that doesn't trip us up with the opportunity for some other government's agenda to then change how the land is disposed of. So I think the bill could be salvageable, and it's well known that we need to do this reform in the conservation legislation space, but I think we're running out of time to do it for this government. But that means that there's an opportunity here for all the parties coming up to the election to have a debate about it. The Environmental Defence Society is having its conference this week in Auckland, and that's going to be a great opportunity to discuss the state of conservation legislation and reform in New Zealand. So I'm excited that we can work forward. And I think New Zealanders continue to be proud of their conservation estate and the work we do, and why tourists and scientists and others come to New Zealand to study and see this. All parties in the government are proud of it. We're just looking at the different ways we can maximise it. And I come back to that key point that with less than 2% of government funding, we do need to be strategic and affordable about how we do our conservation, but it also needs to be sensible and publicly mandated.
That was University of Auckland Professor James Russell speaking to me about the Conservation Amendment Bill.
Gentlemen, this is Democracy Manifest.
The Wire.
100 Kiwi kids are diagnosed with a life-threatening condition called hydrocephalus yearly. Hydrocephalus is a condition where the brain gets an abnormal amount of fluid buildup, which causes harmful pressure on brain tissues. The current standard treatment for it is a shunt implantation, which is a tiny silicon tube which gets inserted into the brain to drain any excess fluid into other parts of the body harmlessly. However, these shunts have the tendency to get blocked about 50% of the time. And if they don't get replaced in time, the raised pressure in the brain could cause huge damage and even death. The major problem is that symptoms of a failed shunt are very common and are hard to interpret. To fix this, researchers have been developing an implantable wireless brain sensor, which will be able to read brain pressure wirelessly and safely at home. To learn more about this new technology and how it will work in the future, I spoke to University of Auckland Senior Research Fellow Dr. Sarah Jane Guild. To start off, could you tell us a bit about what hydrocephalus actually is and how many Kiwis are affected by it?
Sure. Hydrocephalus is a condition where too much fluid accumulates around the brain. So we all have what we call cerebral spinal fluid. Our brain floats in this fluid, and it goes down our spinal column, and we make more of that fluid every day, and it gets absorbed or it drains away. And in some people, for whatever reason, there is a blockage in that circulation of the fluid around their brain. And so fluid accumulates. And that means, if you imagine a balloon and you're blowing up and you're pushing more air in, it expands, but because your brain is inside your skull, it can't expand. So the pressure increases, and when the pressure increases, it starts to squash the brain, and so that becomes a problem. Now, there's around about 100 new paediatric patients in New Zealand are diagnosed with this condition every year. It could be due to congenital reasons, so something different about their brain anatomy from birth, or it could be due to meningitis or a tumour or things like that, and you can develop it as an adult as well.
And what's the current standard treatment for hydrocephalus?
So the treatment for hydrocephalus is life-saving. It's to place what we call a shunt, which is essentially just a tube that goes into the space in the middle of the brain where the fluid sits, and it tunnels out to the skull, under the skin, and all the way often down to the abdomen. And that's life-saving. That drains the fluid away, brings pressure down, and keeps everything stable.
Now, you've been helping in the development of an implantable wireless brain sensor. Could you please describe what it is and how that works?
Sure. So the issue with these shunts is that they block. We think of the fluid around the brain is just water, but it's not. It's got proteins in it, there's membranes, there's all sorts of things that can go wrong. And so these shunts will fail, and as soon as they fail, pressure increases again. And that could be a real problem. And it can be life-threatening within about 24 hours if someone is what we call fully reliant on that shunt to maintain the pressure. So people are very anxious, and even the clinicians are having to make clinical decisions just on how the patient presents, the type of symptoms they have, could be headache, nausea, lethargy, those sorts of things, which are pretty common for just about anyone, but particularly in children. And it becomes very hard to tell, is this just a virus or is it a life-threatening shunt problem? And the only way currently to measure pressure in the brain is drill another hole and put a pressure catheter into the brain. And so, of course, they don't want to do that every time someone has a headache. So what we've done in conjunction with the group at the Auckland Bioengineering Institute as part of our group is to develop an implantable sensor, so a small glass sensor. It's a little about the same size as like a paracetamol capsule that gets inserted into the brain, and that only has to happen once. So they might do it at the same time as they're placing the shunt or replacing it if it needs to be replaced because it's locked. And then the idea is patients can measure their pressure at home and give the doctors more information about what's happening inside their head. So they can hold external reader. There's no battery in the microsensor. It's too small, but it has a what we call a pickup coil, so it can pick up power from the outside. They hold a wand over their head, it looks a bit like a table tennis bat. Hold a wand over their head for 10 to 15 seconds, power the device, get some pressure readings, send it to an app on their phone, and then that goes into a cloud-based database, and they can show the doctors what their pressure has been over time. And so if something changes, they know that, yes, okay, that headache, nausea, vomiting probably is a shunt, or if it stayed flat, they can get some reassurance and think, no, maybe there's something else going on. We need to look for a different source.
You've previously also spoken about the case of a 2-year-old girl who received one of those sensors. What did her experience tell you about the difference this technology could make for patients and their families?
So as I was saying, the challenge is knowing when symptoms are related to an actual shunt failure or if there's something else. So the case you're speaking of, one of the young participants, before they received their sensor in our study, spent 4 days in Waikato Hospital with vomiting, headache, lethargy. She's only 2 years old, so she couldn't tell any more than that. The poor parents knew something was wrong but couldn't tell what the problem was, and neither could the doctors. And so they were spending 4 days trying to work out whether it was her shunt or it was something else. There was no clear evidence either way, so they didn't want to do surgery, but if it wasn't needed, but they needed to work out what was making this child so unwell. And it wasn't until after about 4 days that the mother picked up some significant signs in her eyes of moving a different way that was actually a sign of really high pressure. And that triggered a hospital to transfer her to Auckland Starship Hospital by helicopter and then for her to have surgery. And at that change of her shunt, she joined our clinical study that's just completed and had our sensor placed. So the hope is, and her family really hopes, that next time the shunt fails, they'll have that information to be able to make a decision quicker.
Just to finish off, what difference could the sensor make, not just for patients, but for hospitals and the wider health system?
So every time one of these patients presents to hospital with symptoms that may suggest their shunt has failed and that their pressure is increasing, the clinicians have to make sure that it's not the shunt before they can be comfortable discharging it. At the moment, they're working on very little information. So the patient will undergo observation, they'll undergo scans, those sorts of things. But usually it's the period of observation. So in particular, the ability to make that decision quickly based on concrete evidence of what the pressure actually is inside the brain will be a life changer. And it also means that eventually, once we know, because no one's been able to measure pressure at home before and know what the patterns are, but eventually we might be able to say to some of these patients, if your pressure is normal and you've got these symptoms, you may be able to stay home, have some paracetamol, have a good night's sleep, see how you are in the morning, rather than rushing into hospital wondering whether this is their shunt failure. Or alternatively, if you're at somewhere like the Waikato case or one of the smaller regional hospitals, you've got doctors there trying to make a decision of whether they should transfer the patient by helicopter quickly to somewhere like Auckland with a neurosurgical centre, or whether they can manage them in their local hospital for whatever the alternative cause is. So those decisions, being able to make resource decisions as well will be really important for the health system.
That was University of Auckland Senior Research Fellow Dr. Sarah Jane Guild speaking to me about the development of wireless brain sensors.
We'll be right back after this short break. This is Leathery Whip by Aldous Harding.
Best friend waving at me. I wanna be living with you, seeing it through.
Oh, yeah, let's rock and roll, man.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. That was Besties by Black Country New Road.
You know, cracking open a beer, having a glass of wine while they're driving, while they're on the train and catching up with their mates. Like, it's just a really classy way to get around.
The Wire.
Food Standards Australia, New Zealand is currently consulting on a proposal to make Health Star ratings mandatory, with the present voluntary system coming under fire. Currently, only 36% of eligible packaged foods in New Zealand display a Health Star rating, well short of the 70% goal set by food ministers in November 2025. Additionally, a recent briefing by the Public Health Communication Centre has had nutrition experts arguing that labels can help improve dietary choices, encourage product reformulation, and strengthen transparency. Front-of-packet nutrition labelling is also recommended by the World Health Organization. To discuss making Food Health Star ratings mandatory, I spoke to University of Auckland Professor Dr. Sally McKay. Before we start talking about making them voluntary or mandatory, can you just tell us a bit about Health Star ratings and what impact they can have?
Yeah, so Health Star ratings were introduced about 12 years ago. In both New Zealand and Australia, we have a Trans-Tasman food regulation system, so that's why it's in both countries. And so the purpose is to help consumers at a glance make a quick decision about what a healthier food is in that particular food category. So, for example, if you were trying to choose a breakfast cereal, you would look at the breakfast cereal, see what the Health Star ratings is, and look for one with a higher Health Star rating. So that's the way it's designed to be used. We also find that it encourages food manufacturers to reformulate their products to maybe reduce the sodium or the sugar to get a higher Health Star rating. And the way the Health Star rating is calculated is it looks at nutrients at risk, like high energy, sugar, sodium, and saturated fat, and then it offsets those points with gives like positive points if it contains fruit, vegetables, nuts or legumes, and the fibre and protein content. And then it comes up with that one star rating.
Currently, New Zealand uses Health Stars on a voluntary basis, meaning that companies can opt to use them, but at the moment, the majority do not. Compared to a mandatory model, how potentially limiting is this to Health Stars?
Yes, so in New Zealand, it's only on about 36% of products, and many food companies only display them on the healthier foods. So there are some companies, like the supermarket private labels, that do display them on all products, which is good. But it means that if customers are trying to choose that breakfast cereal and only a third of the breakfast cereals actually display a Health Star rating, it's much, much harder for them to make that choice because they don't have all the information available at a glance. And so if it becomes mandatory, it'll make it easier for consumers, because the Health Star rating will be on all products, and it will also encourage more reformulation as well. So hopefully the products that are on the shelves are a bit healthier.
And how do consumers generally feel about Health Star ratings? Do they approve of them, or is it something they don't like to see on their products?
Yeah, it's a little bit mixed because they're not on all the products. They're not always aware of them or not able to use them fully. So generally they are supportive of Health Star ratings. But there's a little bit of mixed feelings about how well they trust the system. And so the other thing that we would like to see is the algorithm that I talked about, that is reviewed, so that some of those anomalies that we find in the Health Star rating disappear, and so that there's a higher trust in the system as well.
Is it disappointing that the New Zealand Food Safety Minister, as a representative of government, voted against the potential change to go mandatory? And do you foresee further pushback from the government on this proposal?
It was disappointing, but perhaps not surprising, given that our Food Safety Minister, Andrew Hoggart, is from ACT, so fairly right-wing and really wanting individual choice and supporting industry. What we were a bit surprised about was that there was a Cabinet Economic Policy Committee paper where the minister had said that he would vote with the majority of food ministers. In other words, he would say yes to mandatory if that's what other people voted for, which they did. But somewhere from that paper going to Cabinet, there was a decision made to vote against it. So it did seem that he was quite open to it. So it was actually the Cabinet Economic Policy Committee that voted against it. And that is disappointing because it means that when there's the vote for mandatory, the final vote that happens next year, that maybe New Zealand may not support it. But we might have a change of government by then, so it's hard to predict, really.
And how can people get their opinion on this mandatory or voluntary change?
Yes, so they have a great opportunity at the moment because there's a consultation open that closes on the 5th of July, and it's on the Food Standards Australia New Zealand website. But if you just people just Google consultation on health star ratings, they should find it. And people only have to answer the first question. There is 18 questions and some of them are very technical, but if people just answer the first question and say, I would like to see health star ratings mandatory, and then maybe add a few sentences of why it would be useful for them, that would be really good. I think because our food minister voted against health star ratings, we want to show that New Zealanders do actually care about this and that they want some transparency.
That was University of Auckland Professor Dr. Sally McKay speaking to me about making food health star ratings mandatory.
That was The Wire.
Ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki mātou mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rahina Monday. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party's Simon Court, University of Auckland Professor of Conservation Biology James Russell, University of Auckland Senior Research Fellow Dr. Sarah Jane Guild, and University of Auckland Professor Dr. Sally McKay. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongoana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4. But before that, we're going to have Fuck My Computer by Nina Jirachi.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.